Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Sounding Jewish podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Samantha Cooper, and each episode presents my conversations with musicologists, ethnomusicologists, and sound study scholars who specialize in the music and sound of Jewish experience. I am absolutely delighted to welcome you to today's episode
featuring Dr. Sarah Boonen Benor. Thank you so much for agreeing to speak with me today for the Sounding Jewish podcast. I would love to give you the chance to introduce yourself.
Sure, I'm happy to be here. My name is Sarah Boonen Benor, and I'm a professor at Hebrew Union College in Los Angeles. I teach Jewish studies and linguistics, and I run the Jewish Language Project.
Awesome. Before we go any further, I have to ask you to just expand on the Jewish Language Project for those who aren't familiar with it. What does that involve? How did you become the innovator of this project?
Sure. I have been doing public related things about Jewish languages for many years. And in 2020, I consolidated a bunch of my initiatives into one initiative of Hebrew Union College called the Jewish Language Project. We do research and education about Jewish languages around the world with the goal of fostering connection to other people in your family and in your community and beyond, and connections among Jewish communities around the world. Our goals are to document all known Jewish language varieties and to raise awareness about the diversity of the Jewish people.
Fantastic. And as we've discussed a little bit offline, you are a bit of an outlier guest for me because you're the first scholar I've brought on this podcast that has their specialty area in the field of languages and linguistics and not in the specific fields of sound and music. But as you've also said, those two things are interconnected for you. And so I wondered if you could tell me about one of your earliest encounters with Jewish sound or music.
Oh, yes. Well, I guess my first encounter with Jewish sound and music was in the home when I was a baby, and we would speak in a Jewish way and have Jewish music at Shabbat dinners. And well, I went to Jewish preschool and Jewish day school, where I encountered a lot of Jewish music and other Jewish sound. And then I had a klezmer band at my bat mitzvah, and I played violin myself. I actually started taking lessons at my local Jewish community center at age 4, Suzuki Method. And I started learning klezmer music after my bat mitzvah. I took lessons with the violinist from the klezmer band that was at my bat mitzvah. And through that, I got interested in Yiddish, and then I got interested in other Jewish languages once I learned that they existed. But it's all connected, because so much of the way that we engage with language after they're no longer spoken as a vernacular is through music. And so we actually had a song competition at the Jewish Language Project for a song that incorporates elements of ancestral Jewish languages. And we are about to launch a new initiative called Music Monday, where we post songs in endangered Jewish languages. And we do a lot with music. We've commissioned a bunch of musicians to perform original songs or non-original songs. And so I'm very engaged with the Jewish music scene. And I also continue to play music myself. I just performed recently at my synagogue's Erev Rosh Hashanah service. Before the service started, some other musicians and I played klezmer as people were walking in, and I've written some songs myself. So yeah, it's one of my hobbies. Definitely not my main research interest, but one of my hobbies. And also sound and music. I mean, I would say language is part of sound studies because so much of what I am interested in language is about sound. There's also obviously written language, but as a linguist, I'm much more interested in how people speak than how they write.
I heard this from a Chabad young man in Northern California. Whenever you're shaykh, then you can be an aide. Whenever you're not, you're not. So why does Rashi say? That's because dina de machus adina. It's because they're even if not dina de machus adina, Rashi says later, because al din hu nitzdavu b'nei nayach. The gayim are shaykh to dinim, they're not shaykh to gittin. That's why it's good. Is that English? Again, it's Jewish English. Not only do we have Yiddish words, Hebrew words, Aramaic phrases, but we also have the chanting intonation, and we have the release of word final T and the devoicing of final D, the gut instead of good.
That's so fascinating. Can you tell me a little bit about your scholarly trajectory and how you decided that your initial research question was the one for you?
Yes. Well, I guess my initial research question was how do Jews speak? And I came up with that when I was in college, and I was taking a class on Romance languages, and one of the readings was an encyclopedia article that mentioned Ladino, which I had heard of, but it also mentioned some languages I hadn't heard of, Judeo-Italian, Judeo-Portuguese. And I said, "What? Why don't I know about these languages?" And it was that moment I remember closing the book and saying, "This is what I want to do with my life. I want to study Jewish languages. I'm just really interested." And so I have been doing that. I went to grad school. I actually applied in both Jewish studies and linguistics, and I ended up doing the linguistics PhD at Stanford. And I worked on this question for my undergraduate thesis and my dissertation. My undergraduate thesis at Columbia University was about the language of the modern Orthodox students on campus.
This was from a roommate of mine, a modern Orthodox woman. She said, "We do all that shtick to be mesameach, the chatan and kala." Now, is this an English sentence? People who don't know the Yiddish words, the Hebrew words, and even this what's called a periphrastic construction to be mesameach somebody wouldn't understand this sentence. So I say it's not just English, it's Jewish English.
And then my dissertation was about the language of Balei Tshuva, Jews who become Orthodox. And I studied how they're integrated into their new Orthodox communities, partly by learning the Hebrew and Yiddish-influenced English of the community.
Now this is a story about a man named Joe. He did some tshuva, or at least he thought so. But after 15 years, 8 whole months, and just about a week, they still call him a Baal Tshuva freak. Oh, Lord, don't make me into a Benoni. All my friends are tzaddikim. It's so hard on me, 'cause I work on myself, but I'm still a bit confused. Guess I got me a case of them Baal Tshuva blues.
And then I also started working on Jewish languages more broadly, and I did a theoretical article about Jewish languages, and then since then I've written many articles about Jewish English as a Jewish language and all sorts of editorial work to bring people together who study different Jewish languages. I am also the editor of the Journal of Jewish Languages. And the Jewish Language website, which I edit, has many articles about particular Jewish languages and then exhibits about phenomena that can be found in multiple Jewish languages.
That's so fascinating. And I love how the story of how you came to this work and how you realized this was your life's calling was kind of interwoven in the answer you gave me. But on that note, is there specific advice that you would offer to prospective students or new scholars who would like to pursue a similar path to you?
Oh, well, yes, I think it is a really important thing to get the training you need in whatever methodology, whatever theoretical framing you will find useful. And in this day and age, there's so much interdisciplinarity that you can really get that training in any field and then apply it to other fields, or you can get some training in multiple fields. But I think it is useful if you're interested in Jewish studies from whatever angle you're interested in it, like if it's art or if it's media studies or history or religious studies. It is, I think, important to also get the grounding in the broader field and also network in the broader field and publish in the broader field, because that it enriches the work in Jewish studies. I think when people are only in Jewish studies, it is sometimes problematic because they're not keeping up with the broader field. And also, you know, we as Jewish studies scholars have a lot to contribute to our broader fields. So my most cited article is actually not in Jewish studies, it's in sociolinguistics. It's an article about ethnolinguistic repertoire. It's a theoretical approach to how ethnic groups use language. And I have another article coming out soon about, it's called Ethnolinguistic Infusion. It's about how ethnic groups infuse elements of their special group language as a way of fostering ideological links. And that also incorporates music because that's one way that communities do that. They sing songs, perform songs in various Jewish languages.
Shane upon him is my middle, makes my head spin like a dreidel. She's my cook, I'm her knadel. Such a Shane upon him. Shane upon him, canine horror, studied at the Talmud Torah, knows her Sodom from Gomorrah. That's my Shane upon him.
It's an important reminder, not just for new scholars thinking about studying in a certain Jewish-related field, but for all of us to keep in mind how important the connections we build within our initial communities, our external non-Jewish studies communities, and how important those can be. Who have been some of your biggest mentors or advocates or role models on your scholarly journey?
Benjamin Hari has been a very important mentor and role model. He is a professor at NYU and he runs the NYU Tel Aviv School. And he started studying Jewish languages before I did, and I learned so much from his scholarship, and he's been a big advocate for my work. I've also found scholars in music studies to be big mentors and advocates. Mark Kligman is one of them, and he's been very helpful to me. He just reminded me recently that he was on the search committee that hired me at Hebrew Union College, so I'm very grateful to him for that. And I have several mentors within linguistics and Jewish studies, and it's just so great to be in multiple fields and to have access to all these great scholars that can be helpful.
Awesome. So I'd love to ask you to tell me about one of your most recently completed research projects and what has excited you most about it.
Oh gosh, well, there's so many. I mean, to give a general overview of some of the projects that I've worked on recently, there's that article about ethnolinguistic infusion, and there's another article about Jewish names. I did a study, a survey of American Jewish personal names, and that article is forthcoming in American Jewish History. It's about how American Jewish names changed from the 1950s to the 2010s. And then I have another article coming out. Well, it's actually a report It's through JEMENA, it's an organization that stands for Jews Indigenous to the Middle East and North Africa. And the article is it's a study of the experiences of Sephardi and Mizrahi families in LA Jewish schools and camps. And so that's not an academic article because it's not grounded in scholarship, but it is still grounded in scholarship. And it's a very long report. And I think there's a lot there. And I look forward to writing other articles based on that research. I also have another article coming out in an edited volume about contemporary Jewish languages and estimates of how many speakers there are of each of the long-standing Jewish languages. That's coming out in an edited volume in memory of Bernard Spolsky, who was also a mentor of mine. He was an important scholar of sociology of language, sociolinguistics, and Jewish languages. And he was one of the people who asked me to collaborate with him when I was an early career professor. And, we wrote an article together, and then we wrote another article together. And I certainly miss having his mentorship.
It's very special that you get to do something in his honor now. So, yeah, it's nice that these things come back around. Can you tell me what methodological models or tools that scholars in linguistics and you in particular use most often? Because I think they must be different in some ways from musicologists and sound studies scholars as we think of them in the field of musicology, and also how you came to them and developed an appreciation for these tools.
Well, I use mixed methods for most of my research. I have one book about Jewish summer camps and the use of Hebrew. It's called Hebrew Infusion with two other colleagues. And that book was based on interviews, observations, a survey, and historical research. And so those are the methods that I use. And I've used some articles have just one of those methods, some have others. So the article about names that's coming out is based on a survey, and the article that's coming out about Sephardi Mizrahi Jews is based on interviews and a survey, actually. And my dissertation was based primarily on ethnographic observation. I did a year of ethnographic observation. And I know in music studies, there's a lot of ethnographic observation and also analysis of music. And I think nowadays it's very common for people to add in cyber ethnography. And I do a lot of that, analyzing online products, cultural products. I am working on an analysis right now of Long Story Short, which is a show that is very Jewish. It's very Jewishly specific, and there's a lot of interesting language in it. And so that kind of thing is a little different from ethnography, but it's also one of the methods that I use.
Clothes are designed to fall apart, plus they're tacky. It's giving Ungapachka.
Ungapachka?
It means garish.
No, I know Ungapachka. Why do you know Ungapachka?
My For You page gives me Yiddish word of the day. It's fun. Yiddish is camp.
Yiddish is camp?
I
no,
didn't
of
mean
course. Who
camp.
Could forget the B-52's rendition of Oifen
I meant like
Krepacek?
old,
So
but
good,
cool.
so camp.
Okay, such a nudnik.
Kitsch is the word you're looking for. Jews don't do camp, unless it's sleepaway camp or concentration.
Boss!
Okay, have a good day with the other Kinderloch.
And I love using all of these methods. And, the method that I choose really just depends on my research question. And I do miss doing long-term ethnography. It's much harder to do that when you're in a full-time job. You can get a sabbatical and do it then, and maybe I will in the future. But at this stage in my career, it's harder for me to do that. But maybe I will do something like that about Persian Jews in LA or something like that, because there's so much to study there. And I mean, really, it calls for someone in the community to do that research. So if any of your listeners are or know of Persian Jews who are interested in doing sociolinguistic research in Los Angeles or Great Neck, New York, feel free to reach out and I'll be happy to mentor you.
We haven't used the podcast traditionally for networking before, but why shouldn't we start? This is great. Is it okay if I dig a little bit into that previous question?
Of course.
Okay. What I wanted to ask you about was if you might expand on how doing survey work works, because you're the first person we've had who uses this as a key method in what they do.
Yes, and I actually think there's some potential for that in music studies. Because there's a lot that you can learn from a survey. It's different than what you learn from other methods like interviews and observation, but you can get a lot of data. So I'll tell you the first survey that I did was in 2008, and it was a survey of American Jewish language and identity, and it got over 50,000 responses, which is probably the largest survey of American Jews ever. Now, it wasn't a random sample, and so I can't make claims about Americans or American Jews in general based on that. But what I can do is talk about the differences between groups. I can talk about correlations according to age and denomination and that kind of thing. And so that is very expensive to get a random sample of American Jews. And even if you do, it's going to be a random sample of people who are willing to tell a surveyor that they're Jewish. So is that really the population that we want to study? I don't know. So I've been sort of engaged with the broader world of Jewish social science research. I was on the advisory panel for the 2013 Pew study, and I've worked with other colleagues who do this kind of research. And so I know that my approach is not as it's not the gold standard, but it's a different kind of it's a different approach. And then I did another survey in 2019 of Jewish names, and that got over 11,000 respondents. So maybe not quite as popular, but still a large enough corpus of data to really do interesting analysis about change over time and different groups' use of certain types of names. And also on surveys, in addition to the quantitative parts, you can have write-in questions, and those will also get valuable information. In fact, I could probably spend the rest of my career just analyzing the qualitative responses, the write-in responses from those two surveys, because I haven't done that enough. In fact, one of the other projects, I would say my pet project, is about the Jewish names of pets. And that is based on data from the names survey, where we ask them not only about their names, the names of their children, et cetera, but also do they have pets? And if so, do any of them have names that they consider Jewish? And why? And then, so there's so much interesting data there. There's also write-in responses about name change stories in their families. And so, someday I'll find the time to do that. My problem is just that I keep coming up with new ideas for projects I want to do and doing them. And so then I never quite finish analyzing some of the data from past projects.
That's an amazing problem to have, though, I have to say.
Agreed.
Yeah, I really, really hope that you do something with the Jewish pet names because that sounds like a great project. And I know so many Kishkas and matzo balls, and our dog is named Oscar, so I'm not sure if that helps you, but.
Well, that actually is the most common type of name for dogs is human names.
That's so great. I have more questions about every single project you've ever worked on because I think your work is the coolest, but I will move on for the sake of time.
Wait, before we move on, let me just also say how I think music studies can use surveys.
Please,
So
yeah.
one idea is to have a survey with recording excerpts and have people say how familiar they are with each one or what they think of each one. And then that will allow us to make quantitative claims about, let's say we're focusing on American Jews, and let's say we're focusing on liturgical music. You could make claims about how different Jewish communities engage differently with these tunes, with the melodies. And also, you can say something about diffusion of a particular melody within Jewish communities, because you'll have the data on their denomination and their region, and You can also have more information about where they've lived. So, I mean, that kind of thing is exciting to me. And I could see doing a survey that incorporates that with language and culture of other types, food. You know, there's so much to study, and so much of our survey research is focused on a particular set of questions, but I would love to see these kinds of questions incorporated into that survey research as well.
Well, I have some ideas for future research that might involve surveying, so I may be in touch with you about that at some point.
Happy to talk.
So many scholars say that they celebrate the opportunity to teach others as an extension of the research that they do. Can you tell me a little bit about your recent lecturing or teaching or popular-facing publishing experiences and how they've contributed to your research agenda?
Yes, I love the interplay between the teaching and the research. Let's see. I teach mostly undergrads at USC at this point, University of Southern California, and then rabbinic electives at HUC. And so much of my research incorporates what I learn from my students, and I test out my theoretical approaches and my explanations in the classroom and see how it lands with my students. And I sometimes have my students read my articles or listen to my lectures as part of the classes, especially when it's a class that's about my areas of expertise. I'm teaching a class now on Jewish language in the 21st century. And next semester, I'm teaching a class on Jewish names. And in the class on Jewish names, since that's an area that I've just started publishing in recently, I am using that class as an opportunity to compile and analyze data with the help of my students. And so there's so much there. I feel very blessed to be in an academic position where I can do that, where I can teach and do research. Also, my teaching spreads beyond the classroom to my public engagement, and I do feel that I can have a much broader impact through my public engagement than through the classroom, because my classes, I think the largest class I've ever taught is 30 students, and because they're all limited, you know. But I would love to reach a broader audience, and I have done that through articles in the popular press, like in the Forward and JTA, and mostly Jewish venues, but also I've published in Slate and The Conversation, which publishes in many different publications. When I have articles that are of interest to the broader world, like I had an article about auto transcription and about another article about the spelling bee and a few articles about political figures' use of language. And so, but you know, most of my popular publishing has been for the Jewish world in particular. And on my CV, I have two different sections of those. One is applied research, and the other is just other popular articles, other non-academic articles. And I see my lecturing. I do a lot of lectures at synagogues and online lectures, and my social media engagement through the Jewish Language Project and all of the things we do at the Jewish Language Project. I see all of that as teaching and you know, raising awareness about not only the diversity of the Jewish people, but certain linguistic phenomena and particular languages, and how American Jews use language as they construct their identities.
Such a phenomenal answer. Can I ask what kinds of new research questions are currently preoccupying you, if any? It sounds like maybe too many.
Well, yeah, I'm just working on so many different things that. Oh, yes. Okay. So, in addition to all the projects that I've told you about that I'm sort of in the middle of and, you know, that are in various stages, I guess I would say, I am also working on a new project that is not about Jewish studies. I think my first one. No, I did have one paper in grad school that wasn't about Jewish things, but this one is about academia. And it's about how different academics understand their academic life and feel that they are fulfilled or not. And so this is based, it's also mixed methods, and I'm working on this with my colleague Mira Sukharov, and we're doing a podcast called Peer Review: Cultivating Creativity and Fulfillment in Academia. And we've already done a lot of interviews for that podcast. It should be live soon. And then, based on those interviews, we're going to do a survey of academics. And then, based on that, we'll analyze what we find. And the main question is, what makes academics feel fulfilled? And hopefully, that will be applied research, in that the findings of our research will help people to feel more fulfilled in their academic work.
That's so wonderful. You've mentioned that in addition to that podcast, you also run another podcast. Can you tell me a little bit about that and how listeners can find it to check it out?
Yes, and as I said, my teaching and my research and my public engagement are all interconnected, and so that's another major project that I'm working on right now, is about heritage words. And that's what my podcast is about. And I did another interview today for my podcast. So it's called Heritage Words, and it's about heritage languages and how they bring meaning to our lives. I interview people who have a connection to an ancestral language but don't fully speak it. And I ask them about what words they've inherited and how they learned them and how they use them and what they mean to them.
Playing shishbish, playing backgammon all the time, drinking hot tea when it's 100 degrees outside, and also a lot of Arabic. Just like a lot of Arabic, a lot of cultural references, the smells. My grandfather used to walk around with cloves in his pockets.
This is Heritage Words, a podcast about the words we've inherited from our ancestors and the meaning they bring to our lives. And I've learned so much about the Jewish community and about the phenomenon of heritage words. Most of the guests have been Jewish, but we have one episode coming up where I interview both a Jew and a Christian about their connections to Neo-Aramaic. So there's so much potential there for connecting to other communities. And as I said before, I really feel like it's important to speak to the broader world, not just to Jewish studies. So I'm hoping to publish more about this concept of heritage words. That term was coined by Evelyn Dean Olmsted based on her research in Syrian Jewish communities in Mexico. And I think there's so much potential for that as a theoretical construct, and to analyze how communities around the world use heritage words. What semantic domains are they from? How do they change in their pronunciation and how they're integrated into the grammatical system of the language that you're speaking? How many generations are they transferred from one generation to the next? And are there certain communities that are more likely to keep using heritage words than others? And what is the potential application of heritage words for enhancing identities and communities?
So fascinating. And if listeners want to find Heritage Words, can they get it anywhere they get their podcasts?
They certainly can. And yes, we're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, etc.
Amazing.
And then another project that I'm working on is about Jewish names more broadly. And I have a plan for a book about Jewish names that would include family names, personal names, names of pets, of course, and then also other types of names, names of organizations, synagogues, and then pseudonyms that we use in certain contexts. Especially, I have an idea for a comparative analysis of roller derby names and drag queen names, because they're both gender bending pseudonyms, and often they have wordplay and highlight some connection to something Jewish.
That's so awesome. I love it. I will look forward to following both of those projects.
Thank you.
We've come now to the final set of questions I typically ask all of my participants, and I've bent these questions in a little bit of a way to make them a little bit more relevant. But I'd like to just offer them up to you and see what you can do with them. The first question is how you understand the relationship between the field of languages and the field of Jewish sound, and if you think that there are particular challenges that scholars in each of these fields need to remain attentive to.
Well, I see linguistics as kind of a subfield of the field of sound studies because it is mostly about sound. It's, yes, there's also written language, but there so much of the way we do language is involves sound. And it's interesting in linguistics, there are different subfields. There is syntax, morphology, phonology, and then there's prosody. Phonology and prosody are both only about sound, and they involve using instruments to measure sound waves and formants, and those kinds of things are very much part of sound studies, or should be. I don't really know the field of sound studies so well, but I imagine they would be interested in that kind of research. And I haven't done that kind of technical research since grad school, but that is very much of interest to me, and I've worked with other scholars who've done that kind of thing. There's so much there to analyze. And the way that Jews use intonation is particularly interesting to the field of sound studies, I think, because that is a linguistic feature that can often identify people as Jewish. So in my research on Orthodox Jewish English, one thing that I heard from several people is that they can often tell who is Orthodox based on their intonation. So sometimes it's very blatant, like, if you've heard it, you know what I'm talking about. And sometimes it's much more subtle, like, if you've heard it, you know what I'm talking about.
Try to create an atmosphere of simcha that the boys should want to come to yeshiva and they should go home happy from yeshiva. They should be able to accomplish not only in their academics, we also want them to have that geschmack in learning that will take them on to this membership. Baruch Hashem, the hatzlacha that yeshiva has had with all of its divisions from the Masifta through the Beis Medrash and the Kailel, we have seen tremendous hatzlacha and we look forward, as is Hashem, that the hatzlacha should continue.
It's my utmost tefillah, Takanish Baruch Hu, that he gives.
And so that kind of thing is, I think, an overlap between linguistics and sound studies and even music. There's the music of Torah study and Talmud study and how people use their pitch, the variance of their pitch to make meaning, both actual meaning and social meaning.
Parshas Truma, the Haftarah for Parshas Truma is from Melachim, Melachim Aleph, Perek Hey, V'Hashem Nosan Chochma L'Shloimeh Kasher Dibele. Hashem gave wisdom to Shloimeh as he spoke to him, as he said he would.
And linguists study how people use intonation in different ways. You can say the same sentence five ways using different intonation, and it means different things. So I think there's a lot of overlap there. And also, I think there's a lot of overlap in that I'm interested in how people use music as a way of engaging in a post-vernacular way with heritage languages and also educating people about them. So much of the work that we do to reclaim and revitalize endangered Jewish languages is through music. And that's because people find music more accessible than hearing somebody talk in a language they don't understand. If they're hearing a song in a language they don't understand, they can still understand the message to some extent, and they can also gain a better understanding of some of the words and remember some of the words better. So much of language learning, I think, involves learning songs in the language because that cements them in our heads. For example, in my book about Jewish summer camps, I found that camps that had Hebrew productions of musicals tend to really stick in people's minds. Like they remember the play, they can still sing the songs from the Hebrew translation of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat or Frozen or the Beatles. They can remember them years later, and that helped them to learn some of the Hebrew that then helped them later in life.
Do you think that there are particular challenges in Jewish language studies that are kind of constantly on your mind?
I think that Jewish language studies is smaller than Jewish music studies. So that's certainly a challenge. I think that's probably the biggest challenge is that there aren't enough people working on Jewish languages. You know, we have a journal, we publish two issues a year, but I would like to have more scholarship than just two issues a year. And there aren't enough people to study all the languages that there are. And I think that's the biggest challenge is that right now we're in a very pivotal historical moment where most of the longstanding Jewish languages that have been used in Jewish communities throughout history are now endangered. And if we don't record them in the next 20 or 30 years, it will be too late. So that is the biggest challenge. I don't think the challenge of self-definition is so hard because I think interdisciplinarity is the way to go. And we're part of Jewish studies. We're also part of linguistics. And that's how it should be. So I'm not concerned about that. I think one challenge is a theoretical question of what is the scope of our research? And I think that's probably the case for Jewish music studies too. The question, is this Jewish music, is not particularly productive. And I think that's the same with language. In fact, I have an article about that where I argue that asking the question, is a particular utterance or language variety a Jewish language, is not a useful question. Rather, we should ask, how is it a Jewish language? You know, what about it? What makes it Jewish? And where does it fall along a continuum of Jewish linguistic distinctiveness? How does it compare to language use in other Jewish communities and other language use within that community and even within that individual? Yes, that's been a challenge in our field, but I sort of feel like I've solved it, at least for me. Maybe not everyone has adopted my approach, but I don't feel like that's as much of a challenge now. So those are some of the challenges.
Awesome, that's great. Well, I'm going to do the thing that you advise us not to do and ask you that question about if you believe that there's such a thing as a Jewish language, or perhaps to amend that a little bit, what do you think through all of the work that you've done and everything you've seen, what makes a language Jewish?
Well, do you have another 2 hours? I think that there's so much that makes languages distinct. So for me, the bigger question is what is worthy of our analysis? And for me, what is worthy of our analysis is how Jews use language. And in some cases, that might be not very interesting because they might just be using language like their non-Jewish neighbors. But often it is interesting because they're using language in a distinctive way. Either they're using words from Hebrew and Aramaic, from our sacred texts, from modern Hebrew, and from languages that were spoken by their ancestors who came to this country. And that's interesting to me. I'm also particularly interested in not just words, but other linguistic features, other influences from those languages, and then just other features that have developed. And so throughout history, this has been the case that Jews have usually used a variety of the co-territorial language and Judaified it. Incorporated elements from our sacred texts and from our previous Jewish languages. and then archaic features within the language they're speaking because their non-Jewish neighbors changed the way they talk and Jews did not, or vice versa, that Jews changed the way they talk and the non-Jews did not. So those kinds of distinctive features are what I find so interesting. And I would love to see more comparative analysis of that throughout history. I'd also like to see that with music. I recently created a learning module with the Posen Library about contemporary Jewish culture around the world. And there are four lessons: Jewish language, names, music, and food. And so the themes are similar in all four of those areas. And we could also extend that to art and dance and literature and architecture. There's so much to talk about in any cultural domain. So I think using a theoretical framework of Jews being a part of and apart from the surrounding society, acculturation and distinctiveness, I think is a useful approach in any of those cultural domains. And I think that it's interesting to compare how the textual tradition and religious observance influence music, language, food, all of these things, but then also how they're influenced by immigrant cultures and by Jews continuing insularity or integration into the surrounding society.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me today. This was a lot of fun, and I look forward to continuing to follow your wonderful work.
Thank you, and thanks so much for this great podcast. I've been a fan, and I'm glad that I'll finally be on the show, and I look forward to connecting to your listeners.
Thanks for listening to the Sounding Jewish podcast. I would like to take this opportunity to thank our sponsors, the American Society for Jewish Music, the Milken Center for Music of American Jewish Experience at UCLA, and the University of Kansas Program in Jewish Studies. Tune in next month when I will be joined by Dr. Arnie Ingelson to discuss his recent book, Music at World's End, Three Exiled Musicians from Nazi Germany and Austria and Their Contributions to Music in Iceland.